Arab Winter Comes to America, The Truth About the War We're In, is a new book by Robert Spencer, who's written 13 books, including two bestsellers. Robert Spencer is the director of Jihad Watch. He's a weekly columnist with Front Page Magazine, and he has been studying Islam since 1980. Robert, welcome back to the program. It's such a privilege to talk with you.
Always great to be here, Jerry. Thank you.
Sure. All right. Well, let's start by asking you, with, as far as your new book is concerned, what does the title even mean?
What it's about is the denial and fantasy-based analysis and policymaking that prevail at the highest levels of the government and are echoed also in the mainstream media. You may recall, Jerry, the Arab Spring and how it was hailed in the West by both the Obama administration and the media as a wonderful flowering of democracy and pluralism, when actually it was a pro-Sharia Islamic supremacist takeover, as I and just a few others were saying at the time, but which became pretty clear as the events unfolded. And that same detachment from reality, that same fantasy-based analysis, prevails in our response by the from the government, law enforcement, and media in the United States to the domestic jihad threat. And that's what the book is all about, that denial and unreality that is endangering us all.
Huh. Well, you know, it's interesting. The first country, as I recall, was Tunis, and the second country then was Egypt to have this Arab Spring eruption. How are things in Tunis? And I think as far as Egypt, we all kind of know and we see the headlines. Actually, maybe things are turning out better in Egypt, not because of the Islamists, but despite them. But how are things in Tunis? Let's begin with that.
Well, as you know, the Islamic supremacist Muslim Brotherhood regime did crash and burn in Egypt, and so things are taking a turn for the better there. In Tunisia, it is a different story. It's interesting to note that there was a pro-Sharia leader, Rashad Ghannouchi, who was out of the country for many years, exiled, and returned to the country at the time of the so-called Arab Spring, assured people that he did not want to impose Sharia, and then, of course, won power and did try to impose Sharia. But he's receiving some resistance there as well. There's a strong secular tradition there. Tunisia is kind of a follower in the footsteps of Turkey, although Turkey is rapidly re-Islamizing now.
Wow.
For a long time, Turkey, of course, was the lone secular country in the Islamic world, and Tunisia was sort of an echo of it. And now Tunisia is, like the other countries in that area, facing a strong push for complete Islamization and the implementation of full Islamic law. But there is resistance, and so things could still turn out there. What's kind of paradoxical is that while the Islamic supremacists have been turned back and suffered setbacks in both Tunisia and Egypt, in the United States, the Muslim Brotherhood groups in the U.S. are doing just great and advancing on all fronts.
Wow. Okay, so what do you exactly mean when you say Arab winter comes to America?
I mean that there are jihad threats, jihad attacks in the United States, jihad plots, and that in response to them all, there is a uniform reaction from the government and law enforcement and the mainstream media, and that is to say that there is nothing to do with Islam in regard to these attacks. And I understand the impulse behind these things, that they don't want innocent people to be attacked and victimized and so on, and no one wants to see that. The problem is we cannot possibly deal with an enemy. We cannot possibly defeat an enemy we don't dare to name and are forbidden to understand. But as I show in the book, the Obama administration actually has forbidden honest examination of the motives and goals of the jihad terrorists. They have actually ruled out and deleted any reference to Islam and jihad from studies of terrorism and terror and counterterror training. And so these FBI agents and intelligence agents of various kinds, they don't have any idea what the enemy believes, what they're trying to do, and how they might be trying to go about it, because they're forbidden to study such things. And that just endangers us all. As I show in the book also, Jerry, the Fort Hood Jihad massacre and the Boston bombing, among others, could have and should have and would have been prevented were it not for this politically correct denial that kept agents from being able to act upon what they knew about both plots.
And I have seen with my own eyes, in fact, written about a slide that you also have written about as well, that was shown to U.S. Army reservists in training in terms of religious extremism. And the first group listed on that slide that was shown to all these people was evangelical Christians. And then the 10th group listed on the slides were U.S. Catholics. And then the 5th group listed were Al-Qaeda. So the implication is that Catholics and especially evangelicals are more dangerous than Al-Qaeda.
Quite right. And that is exactly the implication, Jerry. It's nature abhors a vacuum, you know. And so when the Obama administration in 2011 definitively deleted and forbade any examination of Islam in connection with terrorism, they had to fill the vacuum with something. And in the book, I've not only got the details of the slide that you're talking about, but information about several other military presentations in which American soldiers were taught that Christianity and various groups of Christians were just as much or more of a threat to the United States than groups like Al-Qaeda.
How can anybody say that with a straight face? I mean, honestly, in terms of, you know, I mean, even Bill Maher, I saw a little video clip where he was talking about, okay, Christians in the 1400s, yeah, they were very dangerous and they were extremists and so forth. But that's not what we're talking about today. The people who are going to kill you are the Al-Qaeda types or the radical Muslims.
Yeah, it is absurd. It's beyond absurd, but it's also, of course, ominous. It would be laughable were it not serious and true.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of alarming to think that the United States government is arraying itself against U.S. citizens and counting them as a greater terror threat than the actual terror threat. But this is the reality of the situation. We have to face it as it is before we can do anything effective to counter it.
Okay, this radio interview is being pre-recorded on June 4th for a little later airing, not too much later, but let's talk about this recent prison swap. That was a Freudian slip, I guess. But talk about the recent prison swap involving apparently a defector who joined the Taliban for all practical purposes. And then meanwhile, 5 key Taliban leaders were let go from Gitmo to get the American back.
It's an appalling scandal, Jerry. It really cannot be understated, because Bo Bergdahl, who the White House tried to pass off as some kind of hero, or at very least as a prisoner of war, it was not anything of the kind. The Pentagon actually made a study in 2010 when he had been in captivity or whatever he was in for a year. The Pentagon study showed that he was indeed a deserter, and thus there was no point in wasting more American resources trying to recover. We capture him. The members of his own platoon say that he was a deserter and that he left a note saying that he had deserted and was going to join the Taliban.
Was he a Muslim?
And, well, it does seem as if he is a Muslim. The Taliban claimed in 2010 that he had converted to Islam and was teaching them bomb making. Now, that seems to be unsupported at the time, but there are several other key bits of evidence. One of the things is that it's come out now that Bo Bergdahl emailed his father and told him that he was ashamed of being an American, and that in that note to his platoon, he had said that he wanted to renounce his American citizenship. And so if he wants to renounce his American citizenship and join the Taliban, then you got to wonder, well, has he converted to Islam? His father certainly has. His father, of course, showed up at the White House at the Rose Garden with Barack Obama wearing the long Wahhabi beard. And you can say, well, you know, Duck Dynasty guy has a long beard and he's not a Muslim. Fine. So we have the long beard, which may indicate and may not that he's a Muslim. But then his father says, the first thing he says to his son, he says his son's not used to speaking English anymore. And so he speaks to his son over whatever connection they've got and says to his son, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Now, tellingly, the White House transcript of this event said he spoke to his son then in Pashto. But that's not Pashto, Jerry. That's Arabic.
Yeah.
And it's Arabic that means in the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, which heads up 113 of the 114 chapters of the Quran. And so he says to his son, this Islamic invocation. The first thing he says to his son after he's been in captivity for 5 years. You go to Robert Bergdahl's YouTube site, and he's got all kinds of Islamic videos on there. And so it seems to me that the trajectory of evidence points to Robert Bergdahl being a Muslim, and with the greeting of his son that way, that his son probably is as well. And that's one of the reasons why he deserted. And then the cover-up would be because the United States government under Barack Obama does not want the embarrassment of a Muslim soldier turning traitor. They want to create the impression that Muslim soldiers are just as loyal Americans as non-Muslim soldiers, and there's nothing to be concerned about them, despite Major Hassan and Nasser Abdo and all the other Muslim soldiers who've gone jihad.
Wow. Okay, we're talking right now with Robert Spencer, who's the director of Jihad Watch, jihadwatch.com. He's written a new book called Arab Winter Comes to America, The Truth About the War We're In, and the publisher is Regnery. Let's talk about the Christian lady who's being held in Sudan. She was pregnant, and because she will not convert to Islam, she will be killed after her baby is weaned. And it's my understanding, by the way, that she is chained up, and when she gave birth to her baby just a couple weeks ago or whatever, within days of this recording, she had to do it while still being chained.
Yes, that's right, Jerry. And it's a very, very tragic case, a terrible case. But she is being held under two provisions of Islamic law. And see, this is the denial that I'm talking about. The Obama administration and a whole political establishment wants to pretend that Islam and Islamic law are completely benign, except for those who twist and hijack its teachings. And this case of Miriam Yahya Ibrahim, who's being held in Sudan, indicates how false that is. Because Islamic law, in the first place, forbids a Muslim woman to marry a non-Muslim man. Now, that in itself is a supremacist law, because the idea is that the woman will go into her husband's household, and so if a non-Muslim man cannot marry a Muslim woman, the idea is, but a Muslim man can marry a non-Muslim woman, the idea is that the non-Muslim communities are always declining at the expense of the Muslim community. But more than that, Miriam Yahya Ibrahim's father was a Muslim. But she never knew her father. She was raised by her mother, and her mother was a Christian who raised her as a Christian.
And now, by the way, where was she raised? In Sudan?
As far as I know, in the United States.
Oh.
I'm not sure entirely. I know that obviously this is a Sudanese family, but her husband lives in New Hampshire. And this is an immigrant family of people who come from Sudan, but I don't think she spent a whole lot of time in Sudan.
Wow.
They were back there visiting family when she got arrested.
Oh.
They don't live there.
Oh, I see. So she was arrested just while visiting. She was and she was pregnant because she and her husband had been married for a while. So she was just visiting, and I assume she's in the Khartoum area, correct? The northern.
Yeah, I think so.
Northern Sudan. Okay.
It's northern Sudan. Southern Sudan, of course, is the Christian area. And apparently her mother is from there. But in any case, she was arrested because under Islamic law, and this is not some twisting or hijacking of Islamic law, this is mainstream Islamic law, she was a Muslim because her father was a Muslim. And if your father's a Muslim, you're a Muslim. And she's raised a Christian. She never knew her father. It doesn't matter. Her father was a Muslim. She's a Muslim. That means that by declaring herself a Christian, she has committed apostasy from Islam, which is punishable by death under Islamic law, because Muhammad, the prophet of Islam, said if anybody changes his religion, kill him. And then, not only that, but because she married a Christian man, as I explained, non-Muslim men cannot marry Muslim women, thus she is also guilty of adultery for engaging in sex to a man she is not married to, because she cannot marry him under Islamic law. It's not possible. And so she is going to be flogged for adultery and then hanged for apostasy.
Oh, my goodness. Flogged like 100 times or something?
Yes, 100 lashes. That's right.
100 lashes. And as I said, she gave birth to a baby. The only thing that's saving her is that the baby needs to be weaned. At least they allow that, as opposed to her, you know, just taking the baby, feeding the baby formula, and then hanging her.
I didn't mean to interrupt, but that story also, Jerry, is based on Islamic law. There is a tradition of Muhammad, the prophet of Islam. A woman came to him and confessed to adultery. And he asked her if she was sane, and she said yes. And he asked her if she was pregnant, and she said she didn't know. And he said, okay, go away and come back when you know. And so she came back a few weeks later and said, yes, I'm pregnant. And so he said, okay, go away till a child's born. So she went away and came back when the child was born. And he said, okay, go away until the child is weaned. And she went away till the child was weaned. And then she came back. He gave the child into the care of someone else and had her stoned to death. And so it is, that story is told as an example of how merciful Muhammad was, that he didn't stone her to death until she'd given birth to the child. But it is also the basis for Islamic law. And in this case, it is being followed with precision by the Sudanese authorities, who are allowing this child to be born and then weaned, and then they're going to kill the lady.
All right. Now, I don't understand something. This, to me, has all the merits of a major story, potentially, in the news. I mean, you would think, my goodness, if, let's suppose she were homosexual or lesbian or something like that, and because she was a lesbian, she was going to be flogged and then hung, you know, she's got this sword of Damocles hanging over her. You'd think the media would report on this. You'd think the media would report on this just on the story itself, and most people don't even know about this story.
Yes, that's right. Well, you know, it's the wrong kind of story. If it were some sort of a fanatical Christian regime that was holding her for adultery, or even adultery and apostasy under some interpretation of Christianity that obviously I'm making up because there is no such group or such country. But if there were, you can imagine the international outcry there would be. And there is, I mean, you take, for example, the group of girl singers who went into a church in Russia and started protesting inside the church, and Vladimir Putin put them in jail. And they got out of jail recently, and they were celebrated at the State Department, and they met Obama, and they had all sorts of meetings in Washington, and they were big heroes.
Those are punk rockers. Until you said this, I didn't realize that they had been protesting at a church. I thought they would.
Yeah, they were. That's why he arrested them, because Putin is very involved with the Orthodox Church, and they went into an Orthodox church and were protesting there. And so they were, I believe, prosecuted, among other things, for blasphemy. I could be wrong about that.
Oh, okay.
I'm going from memory. But my point is, imagine if they'd gone into a mosque. Do you think they'd be celebrated in Washington and meeting Obama? I don't think so.
Wow. All right. We're talking right now with Robert Spencer, jihadwatch.com. By the way, as far as Miriam Ibrahim is concerned, is there anything we can do? I mean, this lady has a death sentence hanging over her, and you know, plus the 100 lashes as well. I mean, this just can't happen. She's going to be killed within 2 years.
Public pressure does work. There have been other celebrated cases of apostasy and adultery, the imminent execution for those two, that is, that has been that the Islamic authorities dropped the cases after a public international outcry. And it seemed as if the other day that that had already prevailed when the Sudanese official announced that she was going to be released. But then the Sudanese government immediately backtracked on that. But I think maybe if we keep up the pressure on them, that they may turn around definitively and release her intact.
Wow. And now let's talk briefly about the 300 captured girls, the ones who were kidnapped in Nigeria. Also Christian victims, Muslim captors, but that part kind of gets muddied in the media reports.
Yeah, a Nigerian Christian organization published a report showing that 90% of the girls that had been kidnapped were Christians. And then Abubakar Shekau, the leader of the group, Boko Haram, which is actually the official name of it, is the Congregation of the People of the Sunnah for Dawah and Jihad, Sunnah being Islamic practice and Dawah being Islamic proselytizing. So they're very much an Islamic group, despite reporting to the contrary in the Western media. He confirmed it when he said that the girls had converted to Islam, which obviously meant that they were not Muslims when they were seized.
Right.
In any case, that too is proceeding according to Islamic law. There has been a flood of articles over the last few weeks in all kinds of major news outlets saying this has nothing to do with Islam and this is a violation of Islamic law and so on. But I noticed that none of them, not a single one, addressed the fact that the Quran, in four places, talks about the captives of the right hand, who are essentially sex slaves, captured women who are infidels, who are pressed into sexual slavery. And this is allowed in the Quran and in Islamic law. And so Boko Haram wasn't doing anything against Islamic law by kidnapping and enslaving these girls. It's something Muhammad himself did.
Wow. Okay, let's suppose, and I hope this is not the case, but let's suppose the 300 girls never get released, they never get returned to their families and so forth. What would happen to them? Would they be sold into sex slavery?
Yeah, actually, Shekau has already said that a lot of them have been sold off to Boko Haram members for about $14 each.
Wow. And they would be just sex slaves. So there's slavery existing in our world today, and some of it occurs in the Muslim world.
Oh, not just some of it. I would say most of it. I mean, I know that there's all sorts of horrible, shadowy things going on in the West as the West grows increasingly depraved and post-Christian and anti-Christian.
Right.
And there's all sorts of sexual exploitation and human trafficking and so on. And I'm fully aware of that.
And there are strict laws about sex trafficking and labor trafficking as well. If there was some sort of human trafficking ring that was definitively, you know, proven and then busted and so forth in the United States, they face some pretty strict penalties. So, I mean, at least the laws exist.
This is the problem. This is the difference. The laws do exist. And actually, you can say technically in the Islamic world, laws against slavery also exist. You have Niger, which outlawed slavery in 2003, and that kind of thing. Very late outlawing, especially in North Africa, of slavery. It's only been in the last 10 or 15 years. And even then, the problem is that because it's legal in Islamic law, it is widely practiced even despite the fact that the nations have the national laws have banned it. And this is the problem, that because slavery is allowed in Islamic law, a lot of Muslims just don't care if the national government has banned it. They figure that the Islamic law is higher than the laws of the state.
All right, we're talking right now with Robert Spencer. The name of his newest book is Arab Winter Comes to America, The Truth About the War We're In. Now, when you talk about attacks, let's say, occurring here in America, we know, of course, about the two famous ones. You mentioned them, the Fort Hood shooting and the Boston Marathon bombing in 2013. What other attacks are you referring to? Or is it more like attacks that were in the works and then they got thwarted, and thankfully the people were arrested before the attack happened?
Well, there have been thwarted attacks, and we can be grateful for that.
Yeah.
But a lot of the circumstances of the thwarted attacks shows just what a fix we're in terms of the Arab winter being in America and in terms of the denial about it. And also the ongoing campaign, which has been highly successful by Islamic supremacist groups like the Hamas-linked Council on American Islamic Relations to so demonize the resistance to jihad terror that people are intimidated and afraid, and they think there's something wrong with resisting it. I think the primary example of that is the Fort Dix plot. Not many people know, but a few years back, there was a group of Albanian Muslims who plotted to go into Fort Dix and kill as many American soldiers as possible before they themselves were killed. And the plot was not foiled by the FBI or by any other law enforcement agency. The plot was foiled by a 17-year-old kid who worked in a video store because these jihadis, they liked to watch gory jihad videos of beheadings and amputations and jihad bombings and so on. The problem was that they had all this on VHS tapes. So they took the VHS tapes to a local video store in New Jersey to get the videos transferred to DVD. This 17-year-old boy, Brian Morgenstern, was working in the video store, and he was doing the job, transferring these tapes to DVD, and he sees the images going by, and he's profoundly disturbed, and he thinks these guys might be up to something. They might be plotting no good. You know, they obviously love blood and death. And so he went to his boss, and he said this, and Jerry, this still, you know, it amazes me.
Yeah.
Whenever I think of this, it's astonishing. He said to his boss, "I'm seeing some very disturbing things on these videos. Should I call the police, or would that be racist?"
And what does his boss say?
The boss encouraged him to go to the police, and he did, and the boss was spoiled. But the point is, why would he even think that to call the police on people who obviously loved and were glorifying murder and death and destruction would be racist? He only thought that because of the highly successful campaign by these Islamic supremacist groups and their leftist allies in the United States to so demonize the resistance to jihad that he thought he had internalized the 17-year-old. He had internalized the idea that there's something wrong with resisting jihad terror. You just don't do it. It's racist.
And if the Fort Dix plot hadn't been, you know, exposed and so forth and dealt with, you know, what would have happened? What was the goal there by the jihadists?
They wanted to murder as many American soldiers as possible before they were themselves killed, and then they would get the virgins in paradise, as per the Quran, chapter 9, verse 111, which guarantees paradise to those who kill and are killed for Allah.
Wow. You know, it's crazy. I mean, I don't know why we have to keep repeating the same mistakes. It's almost criminal, in a sense, the sin of omission on the part of the mainstream media when it comes to radical Islam. I mean, they want to kill us. And it's like it has been said so often before, Islam divides the world into two parts, the House of Peace, which is submitted to Islam, the parts of the world submitted to Islam, and the House of War, that which is not yet submitted to Islam.
Yes, and the Quran says, Muhammad is the apostle of Allah. Those who follow him are merciful to one another, but ruthless to the unbelievers. Chapter 48, verse 29. And that dichotomy runs all the way through Islam, that Muslims are to be treated with mercy and kindness and charity, but not non-Muslims.
Okay, now, you're playing off of the theme of Arab Spring when you talk about Arab winter comes to America. Would you say that anywhere in the world where the Arab Spring began to sprung, you know, a few years ago, that it turned out well?
No, nowhere did it turn out well. Everywhere it brought pro-Sharia groups to power. Now, in some cases, those pro-Sharia groups so alienated the populations in the subsequent months
they overreached. That
they were toppled, like notably in Egypt. Yeah,
yes.
They overreached, and they always overreach.
Right.
And so that may be our best chance that they will continue to overreach. But certainly none of the advances that they have made could they have made alone. They only are able to make these advances because of the ignorance and willingness to aid them of useful idiots who are non-Muslims in the West.
Yeah,
and that's what the book's about.
And unfortunately, there's so many of them. JihadWatch.com for more information. Let me ask you a question, Robert. Robert Spencer, again, author of Arab Winter Comes to America. Where in the Muslim world is there strict Sharia law in place where even the Muslims, the strict Muslims, are happy? Yeah, this is working out. Northern Sudan,
well, I don't
Saudi
know
Arabia,
anywhere that the strict Muslims are happy, because there's always more Sharia you can implement.
Oh.
But yeah, Saudi Arabia and Iran and Sudan are Sharia states.
Northern Sudan.
In Pakistan is almost a Sharia state. It's essentially a Sharia state.
Wow.
But the funny thing about it is that it's not Sharia enough for the hardliners.
Wow.
And they have been, as a matter of fact, as a group, the TTP, which is an Islamic group in Pakistan that has vowed warfare against the government until they implement Sharia. And then some people have said, wait a minute, we already implement Sharia in Pakistan. What are you talking about? But it's not enough for them.
Well, you know, you can never solve a problem if you misdiagnose it. And that's why the books of Robert Spencer are so important. Again, he's the director of Jihad Watch, jihadwatch.com. By the way, jihad is spelled J-I-H-A-D. And again, his new book is Arab Winter Comes to America. Robert, keep up the great work, and thanks again for joining us.
Always a pleasure, Jerry. Thank you.
Thank you, and God bless. Bye-bye.